welcome to YouTube.com and MSN. It's sure everybody listening online at the moment. And welcome, more importantly, to YouTube. We've got Bono and Larry and Edge. I'm Joe Wiley from Radio 1 and the BBC. Hello, welcome along.
Hello, Joe. How are you doing?
How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Now, you are all where?
Bono, you first.
What?
Bono, where are you? What can you see?
I'm in the office of Rolling Stone magazine, where I just had a meeting with a load of the journalists here and the staff here, and they let me bend their ear about Africa and AIDS for an hour and a half. So they're all and then
you're not all talked out, are you?
I'm not. I'm just warming up.
Okay, Larry.
I'm in upstate New York. I'm just on a bit of a sabbatical with me family.
Okay.
For a few weeks.
And Edge.
I actually happen to be in New York as well, but I didn't know that Adam or Larry and Bono were in New York. I am in the offices of Principal Management, looking out the window across West 57th Street.
And you're up for a pint afterwards, are you, Edge?
I certainly am.
You see, I thought you were kind of faking this when you were talking, we were talking a little bit beforehand, and you were saying, oh my God, you're in New York as well. I think people would be very, very surprised to know that you didn't actually have a clue you were there.
Well, having spent the last 22 years joined at the hip, it's actually something we relish, having to know where the other members of the band are. So it is actually an unusual situation, but it's one I quite enjoy.
Okay, and we should point out here that Adam is in Nepal, in the Himalayas at the moment. We will hopefully get him online and we'll be talking to him as well. Surprised that that's where he is?
He's always had a bit of the wanderlust, our Adam, he's out searching enlightenment, God knows we need that.
Do any of you genuinely know what he's doing there?
I presume he's walking, because I don't think the public transport is particularly good in the Himalayas. I'm sure he's just enjoying the scenery.
I'm sure he is. Listen, I'm also by some flowers and a bottle of champagne and some Guinness, which has come courtesy of you lot. So I should say thank you very much indeed for that. It just turned up about 5 minutes ago.
What it is there should be instructions with it, Joe.
I'm just opening it. Half Guinness, half champagne. In Dublin, they call this
Black Velvet. We thought you might like that.
You know, I'm always up for getting educated when it comes to drinks. I shall be trying that later on tonight. Now, we're going to go through loads of questions. We've had tens of thousands of questions coming in from all over the world, so we better crack on and do some of these. First one says, Dear Bono, Edge, Larry and Adam, I absolutely love Electrical Storm and was wondering if you could tell me what inspired the lyrics to this song. Bono, do you want to go with that one?
It's hard. You know, I generally, when I'm writing songs, I mean the lyrics to songs, I try to put into words what the band are doing musically. You know, the lyric tends to grow out of the melody, and the melody grows out of the chords and the way the band, the music the band are making. Mm. The title Electrical Stork came to me as a sort of just a suggestion about just the nervous times that we live in. And post 9/11 and all that, but actually it ended up being a song just about lovers trying to clear the air, really, and just left it there.
Okay, Larry, if I could just ask you about the video for this. Congratulations, I love it.
Thank you.
And so does everyone I speak to. How much hard work have to go into the romantic scenes?
Well, you know, it was. One of the hardest day's work I've ever had. It was very tough getting my arms around Samantha, who I have to say was fantastic. Samantha Morton was really very cool. And it was an odd and interesting experience. And I have to say, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
A little alarmed after I saw it. Because during the day, you just get into the swing of it, and off you go, and you're there, you're romancing in a bath, and
with a mermaid.
With a mermaid putting TVs out at sea, as you do. That's France. And all of a sudden, you watch back on TV, and there are...
And you're a porn star.
And I'm a porn star. It's electrical porn.
No, I mean, it's very sexy, but it must be very embarrassing to watch back, I can imagine.
It's kind of odd, I have to say. It is odd to watch back, but, you know, it's like, you know, the guys, I've been struggling for years and years to figure out what to get me for my birthday, so that was an early birthday present.
Okay, we'll move on to another question. This is from Jamal. He says, hi, you two. I'm an African living in the UK, and just want to let you know, I think you're the best band in the world. You'll have very big hearts for the underprivileged people around the world. My question is, what prompted you to start the fight against poverty? So it's a bit of a big one, bit of a big question. Who wants to go with that one, Edge?
Well, I have to say, Anna should probably be answering it, but I think as it relates to the band, which is, I suppose, you could say that the band over the years have had a kind of interest in taking advantage of our situation. And I suppose that the reason why we have over the years got involved with various different issues and been part of movements is really a sense within the band that there comes with the great success that we've had a great responsibility to do something, to give back something. And whilst none of us ever want to try and forget that the reason we have the opportunity is because of music, so that the focus for us always has to be music first. But the other things that we do are really important to us, very necessary, and without them, I don't think we would be in the position we are.
Do you think every band who has the kind of success you do has that kind of responsibility? And do you think enough bands actually realise that, recognise that, and sort of get on with the job?
Well, I don't think it's just relating to bands. I think it's just relating to people who, like we, live incredibly privileged lives. And I think that there's great examples of people who do have those kind of epiphanies and decide to do amazing things. You know, somebody like Bill Gates, who I know gets a lot of bad press, but I mean, the work he has done over the last 3 or 4 years is absolutely astonishing. So, I think
no single person has done more than Bill Gates.
Really?
Yeah, for the people in Africa and the developing world, it's kind of extraordinary. And you know,
a lot of people would be quite ignorant to that.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, he's spending fortunes, billions and billions, trying to research. Particularly immunization of children and put into practice supporting research and then putting into practice these programs to immunize kids from malaria and all kinds of things. And it's amazing. And then there's just people on the street. This is Bono. Just regular people, mothers, who got involved in the Jubilee 2000 campaign. I mean, it wasn't just student activists. People got out on the street in large numbers who just regular jobs. And I think that, in a way, they're the ones that the politicians are afraid of. They're not afraid of me or, you know, the regular student activists. But when people get out on the streets who they don't expect, like mothers, and say, look, it's not acceptable that an accident of longitude and latitude can decide whether you're going to die of AIDS. You know, if you lived in London or New York, you can live because you can get access to the drugs, but if you're in Africa, you can die because you don't. I don't think that's acceptable anymore. People are getting out on the streets to say it.
Okay. We'll move on. Nancy Bailey said, what was the hardest album you've made to date, and which one came the easiest? So, Larry, do you want to do that, the hardest album you've made to date?
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Great. I think again, these are personal things. I think one of the most difficult records was Oxygen Baby. It was just a tough record to make. We went to Berlin. I mean, the story is well documented. I think before then, October was a very difficult record to make, and one of the reasons for that was all of the lyrics got stolen again, well documented. I think the reasons that records are difficult to make tend to be more to do with external matters than internal matters sometimes.
Okay.
And that was, in my experience, that's what it was. The best fun record to make, there are always fun moments making records. Well, I mean, they're hard work, but the easiest record for me to make, I think, and the one that I enjoyed most, was Europa.
Okay. Ed, are you in agreement?
Yeah, I think also the Boy album was a great record to make because we had so much time to prepare all the arrangements for the songs, and so when we actually got in the studio, it was a time to just experiment, to discover what the studio was about, and we had a great producer with us, Steve Lillywhite, who was leading us through the process because we'd never made an album before, and it was a real pleasure to sort of record our songs and to bring them forth, you know, and to find out what they could be when recorded with a bit of artistry. And that was a really great moment for us, I think, as a band.
I'd run with that too. Boy, it was just a lot of fun because we'd worked up the songs live and we knew what they were and we recorded really quickly. It was in and out in 3 weeks.
A triumph. And what about the most difficult, Bono?
I'd run with Axum Baby.
Because?
I think there was some tension in the band about which way we were going, and you know, we were enjoying a certain amount of experimentation, but I think there was genuine concerns that what was unique about U2 might get lost in that experimentation. And we were sort of pushing the band to its elastic limit, that and Zeropa, and we didn't know where the walls were, you know. And then I suppose on Pop we actually walked into a few walls.
Came up with bruises, but then carried on.
That was the funnest. Actually, that might have been since our first album, the funnest album to make was probably Pop, until at the very end we kind of ran out of stamina. Still very, very proud of that record, the songwriting on that record, but with the finishing of it was we had run out of gas.
Yeah. Okay, Bono, another one for you. This is from Nikki Kopus. That's his name's right, and apologies if I'm getting any of them wrong. Nikki is curious if you constantly talk to yourself.
Wow.
I don't know what I mean by that, to be honest.
That's a great question.
That is a great question. I'm too busy ranting to get time to listen to myself. I wake up in the morning, I must say. I wake up in the morning with questions that I try to answer over the day. And that's as close as I get.
Okay. Do you dream very much?
Yeah, I do, and I tend to. But the most exciting dreams for me are the waking dreams. You know, the ones that you have when you're walking down the street, and you know, you get a big idea in your head, and you figure out a way of trying to realize that idea. They're the best ones. Like, I think, again, some of the political work we've done over the while has felt like a waking dream. And that you have to then make, you know, this abstract idea, you've got to make it concrete. I really like that. I don't believe in wishful thinking, you know, sort of dreams and, you know, that sort of thing, you know, Imagine, that John Lennon song, you know, it's my least favorite of his songs, and he's the man for me, but it's like, I don't believe in that imagining is enough. You have to imagine, but then you have to, you know, you have to build it. And with concrete and scaffolding and the sort of unromantic aspect is to me now more interesting than it was, say, when I was younger and I thought just having the dream was enough.
Okay. This is from Martin McLaughlin. My question is, if you knew 20 years ago what you know now, would you do anything in your career differently? Edge, can you answer that one for us? 20 years ago, what have you learned?
Well, I would have kept up the bagpipe lessons. I let slip. 20 years, I don't know. I think
you took the high road there, didn't you?
Yeah, I was thinking, every record we, to some extent, at the end of it, you want to go in and make it all over again. But really, I think that's because we're such ridiculous perfectionists. And I'd actually, really, if you put the gun to my head, there's nothing I would do differently.
Really?
Yeah.
What about Bono?
Well, I'd start with the mullet.
Yeah. The DVD collection must be quite excruciating at times for all of you to have to watch that back. I mean, the CD collection is obviously like a wonderful scrapbook. So the DVD is a pretty painful documentation, I'd imagine, of mullets.
Oh, well, it's the 80s. That's what, I'm glad we're on to the best of the 90s. And, because the mullet, is definitely, something. I don't think people should ever look like their hair has been ironed.
You're talking about Larry Hill or yourself?
Hey, Joe, steady on there.
It's a flat iron.
Larry, is there anything that you would that you wish you knew 20 years ago?
I think I'd change now if I'd known it 20 years ago. I think there probably are lots of things, but, I think everything is as it should be. I think had various things on a personal level been different, I think the course may have changed. But answer the question directly.
The course?
Oh, okay, what do you mean?
The course may have changed.
Don't change. That's perfect.
3 minutes, Jim.
Okay. A question here from Navid, we'll go with this one. I was wondering which of your many concerts that you've done over the past 22 years has been your favourite to each of you then. Larry, do you want to go with your favourite gig ever?
I think that, you know, that there have been a few moments that are, really outstanding. They're, you know, first time playing in Slane Castle with Lizzie. First time playing in Crow Park with you two, first stadium in the U.S., and then it goes on. But the one that probably stands out more than any other one is Sarajevo, when we played there on the Pop Mart. There's no doubt that is an experience I will never forget for the rest of my life. And if I had to spend 20 years in the band just to play that show and to have done that, I think it would have been worthwhile. It was an amazing experience.
Is that the same for the other two, Edge?
Yeah, Sarajevo, I have to say, is hard to beat. We did the show at a time when most of the people who lived in Sarajevo were really still trying to persuade themselves that the war was really over. And so for a long time afterwards, we were told in Sarajevo they would refer to before and after the U2 concert, like it had become some kind of weird milestone, some signification that war was really over. And even people who didn't know what the band was about or didn't know music, presumably a lot of people never heard of U2.
Mm.
There was something resonant about the fact that a concert had gone on at that moment in time. And every person we spoke to, all the UN troops, all the locals, everybody was just so delighted that this was possible. And it was only possible because of all the hundreds of people, both on our crew and people that worked in the city itself, that really some of them put their lives on the line to make it happen. And I think there was a lot of risks taken to make it happen because it was still such early days. But it went off so brilliantly, and I mean, it was an incredible and incredibly emotional.
They ran trains into Serbia and into Croatia. They put on a special train. The lines, the railway lines, had been down, and they were reopened for that.
Gosh.
to get the three main groups represented, which was amazing.
Well, is there another gig that means an awful lot to you or meant an awful lot to you in your career?
Maybe Belfast, the Waterfront Hall, to try and help the campaign to pass the Good Friday Peace Agreement.
Yeah.
Up in, I think that was a great moment for us. Again, it was, you know, there were, it looked like it was a potential pratfall, and you know, we're from the south of Ireland, not from the north of Ireland, and I think the people in Belfast, that they were very generous to let a southern band be on stage. Mm. We were on with Ash, who are an extraordinary band. They're from that part of the country, and they had a real reason to stand there. We felt we had a reason too, because everyone would benefit or suffer if the peace agreement was to pass or not. But it was a very, very emotional moment. We brought the leaders of the Catholic community and the leader of the Protestant, on. And I asked the two politicians to do something that would be almost impossible for a politician to agree to. And they both asked me, what was that? This is in the dressing room beforehand. I said, I'm going to ask you to walk out on stage and not say anything. This is about a photograph. And but yeah, we're going to ask you to shake hands in public, because they'd never done that before. It was really a great moment.
I'd imagine also playing America after September 11th. There were some pretty powerful gigs there.
Oh, God. That was off the map. Completely off the map.
The first gig you did?
Yeah, just coming. We were the first band to come into New York. First big band. Most people cancel their tours. Mm. I think people... Americans really were pleased that we hadn't, and we had a tribute to all the people who'd lost their lives on the and we had their names projected and on our TV, on our sort of screens at the back of stage, to remind people that, you know, they weren't statistics, they're actually people. And as the roll call went in Madison Square Gardens, I think it felt like a whole nation was just in tears, and everyone, I've never seen a rock and roll show where everyone is weeping, including the band. You know, it was a very, very extraordinary moment. And
to perform and sing through that, though, must be extraordinary.
Yeah, because people were spotting the names of people they knew going by. And you would see families, you'd see the three names. Obviously, you know, a father, son, and a brother, or a daughter. I mean, it was overwhelming. And again, to be let in to that level of intimacy. I mean, we were, again, it was a risk. But I think people knew that we were doing it in a very respectful way.
Okay. Can I just check at this stage? It's all going so well so far. You're being looked after, watered, and fed, and everything.
This is mad, isn't it, though?
Isn't it the most bizarre experience?
I've never been in a chat room. And now we're having
stage,
this is the biggest chat room, and there's no walls in it, and just coffee.
Coffee,
that's
what
Adam, though? Have we found him?
I don't know. Adam, I don't think Adam's with us just yet.
I'm here. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, we can hear you, Adam.
Oh, my goodness, I'm in. Well, good afternoon, New York, and good evening, London.
Very welcome, Adam. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm in tomorrow at the moment.
What exactly are you doing there?
Well, there's a very interesting Hindu festival here at the moment called the Festival of Light. And they're celebrating their new year, and they're 57 years ahead of the rest of us. So it's 2057 here in Rishikesh.
Wow.
Adam, that makes you in your 90s. How do you feel?
I feel as young as a spring chicken, actually. It must be the restorative Ganges water here. I think that's what it is.
Have you been in the Ganges, Adam?
Ganges, that's a river.
Yeah, have you been in it?
No, I haven't done yet. It looks a little dirty.
That would be an amazing thing.
It would be, yeah. Adam, I have a question for you.
Yeah?
This is from Morgan. It says, do you really have a spoon collection? I presume this has hidden meaning.
I do now, thanks to The Simpsons, but prior to appearing on The Simpsons as a voice, no, I'd never even heard of anyone who was a spoon collector.
Explain what the film
I don't know where they got it from, but it's certainly changed my life.
Okay, and there's another question for you while we've still got you. This is from Jason Peterson. It says, your Blue Room is one of the tracks on the Best of compilation, and it's also the only song that includes your voice. No offence to Bono, of course, but do you think we'll get to hear your voice on anything in the future?
You know, that's a tricky one. You know, that opportunity only comes around sort of once or twice a decade. I don't know, you know, it's very hard to find material that suits my voice, but occasionally something comes along and, you know, I'm open to suggestions.
Maybe you could do a cover of Wandering Star or something. Oh. Lee Marvin did it first.
I'd love to do that.
Okay, I've got some more questions for you. We'll talk about the next album then, because there's quite a lot of people asking this. Andrea Barber in particular. What will be the theme of the next album? Oh, no. Do you want to go with that one or Edge?
Well, we don't really know ahead of time. You know, you don't sit down and say, oh, I'm going to write one about Thursday afternoons. You know, when you're writing a song, you sort of, as John Lennon put it, you sit down with your guitar and open a vein, and whatever comes out, comes out. So,
okay, so when do you think you'll be sitting down to record it?
Well, we're actually, we're working on it at the moment. I'm putting together on my Macintosh. I know Bonner's working.
I have to tell you this, because Larry and Adam haven't heard it, but Edge brought round a CD of a new tune. It's just a provision title, Full Metal Jacket. It is the roughest. It is a mother. It's the mother of all rock and roll tunes. I don't know what. I don't know where it came from, but it's a remarkable guitar thing. You want to hear it? It's a reason to make a record. This song is that good.
Wow.
Unfortunately, Edge is singing on us, but.
Just doesn't need Adam then. Okay, so
we're at the great early phase where it's all about possibilities, and nothing has to be ultimately, you know, it doesn't have to be finished right now. We just can, you know, try out all sorts of things and see where it takes us.
It must be one of the most exciting times.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's the best of the best thing. Being in a band is to wake up in the morning with a melody in your head, or to be in a studio when the band, you know, stumble onto a great song and it forms in front of your eyes, and it is the most exciting thing about being in U2.
I guess that's one of the reasons to just keep on keeping on being in a band, because, you know, so many bands kind of quit. But while you still get that feeling, while the possibility's still there.
Actually, I want to tell Larry that the tune Bon is talking about, I used some of the drum loops that you did last week, and they sounded really amazing in itself.
Excellent. Which drum loops are they? Are they the ones that we did in the studio with, you know, your man who does the drum loops?
Okay, this is a global webcast.
That's a business to deal with, all right? That's how great records get made.
Can I just ask, are there people that you still want to work with? Be them, you know, vocalists or producers? Have you kind of got a wish list at the moment?
Well, we've been very lucky, you know. We have worked with some of the greats, we think, you know. But Rolf Harris would definitely be high on my list.
I think it's with Jarvis Cocker. They're doing something together.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, Steve Lillywhite, who produced, this is Bono here, Steve Lillywhite, who produced our first few albums and then has always come in the end from the Joshua Tree right up to All That You Can't Leave Behind, he said one of the most innovative people he's ever worked with in a studio was Rolf Harris. Rolf Harris was famous for the song Two Little Boys. And in fact, on occasions, Ed and myself are known with some drink taken to sing it. But apart from that, you know, he was Australian. He used to play the didgeridoo, and he had a wobbly board. And Steve Lillywhite said in the studio, he was just one of the most innovative people. He was always looking for ways of making new sounds and everything. So, big up Rolf.
Big up Rolf, okay.
All right. He also, wasn't he behind the stylophone? Remember that thing?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he promoted it.
Yeah.
What's the most trouble the drinkers ever got you into, Larry?
I have a family to look at.
Yeah, listen, we've done the video already, so I think, you know, there's nothing we can't talk about.
I can answer that question.
Go on, then. I thought you might.
Because it's a particularly spectacular. If you're going to drop a name, drop a big one. But I tried to keep up with Frank Sinatra. Jack and Ginger was his particular cocktail. Jack Daniels and Ginger.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to keep up with him, and I ended up falling asleep in his house on a couch, and when I woke up, I thought something dreadful had happened, but in fact I just spilled my drink.
That'll do. Rita from the Lebanon said, I want to ask every one of you, what's the most important event in his life? Edge, can you answer that one for us first? It's a bit of a biggie.
It's a big one, and it's, well, I think the birth of my children has to be the most amazing and important event in my life. But
Are you a hands-on father? Wait, I mean, when you're actually there at the birth, you kind of the eyes are open and you're kind of encouraging, or are you outside?
I'm actually fairly a new lad in that sense. I do try and be there. It's with the touring schedules and all. I actually have failed to be there on one occasion, which wasn't a great thing. But apart from. My daughter Cyan's birth, I have been at all my other children's births. It is,
and there are many.
And are there tears every birth?
It's just so astonishing, you know, to be there, and you know, you can't describe what you're feeling. So that has to be for me.
Okay. Larry. What's the most important event in your life?
Well, it has to be when in the early 70s the Irish government had a huge backlog of provisional drivers, and so they had an amnesty and we all got full driving licenses in 1912. So that was definitely the most important moment of my life, because it meant I could drive on my own as opposed to my father. It was a very, very big deal.
Bono, bumped into anything lately? In your car? Because the driving is legendary, of course.
Well, you know, people often point to Larry as a very good example of why they should have sorted out that backlog. And they point to me as a very bad example, because I did get my hands on a driver's license, and most of my friends don't think I should have.
What would be the most important event in your life?
I think getting married.
Yeah?
I think my marriage, yeah, I mean, it was a long time ago, and I know I was late.
You were late?
Yeah.
What was the reason?
There was a big crowd, I couldn't get in from the back.
Okay.
And there was a load of out-of-tune tin whistle playing and stuff. But it was a very, very big event for me.
Okay, Adam?
Hey, Adam?
Can you hear me?
By the way.
Have we lost Adam?
No, I'm here.
Oh, hello. What's the biggest event of your life so far? It's a major question.
So far, well, the biggest one I was there for would have to be my own birth. That was about 9 months after my conception. So, that's a big one, and I'm still getting over it.
And does everyone who knows you?
What?